Okay.
That's what I put in here, my note.
Okay, so we did the Banking Act. So we did the Banking Act of 1933, and then the Banking Act of 1935, restructuring the Federal Reserve, which actually made it even more independent of the government. Ay, ay, ay. And then the FDIC legislation we talked about.
What slide are you on?
I'm just sort of reviewing the slides, one by one.
Well, which one are you talking about?
We're in banking Glass-Steagall. Very important laws that came out of the Great Depression. And then about the going off the domestic gold standard, we have the change in the law about the gold standard, Executive Order 6102, and 1934 Gold Reserve Act that revalued the gold owned by the Treasury. So the Treasury saw the value of their gold increase overnight by $2.81 billion. Which is a lot of money back then. Then we talked about securities. I think this is the last thing we talked about, the securities, the short selling. So, and then how margin requirements were raised so that if you wanted to borrow money to buy stock, you had to put down more money. Okay. Oh, and I forgot to find out what the margin requirements are for today. But in 1949, the 50%, you had to put down half the amount of money to buy the stock. And then the other half would come from the broker as a loan. And behind the broker would be a commercial bank loaning to the broker. Yeah. Did we do the Social Security Act?
We're in FDR time, aren't we, at this
yes.
point?
Yeah, it's Thomas Paine from before the Revolution.
Why don't we start here? Because I think this,
yeah,
I don't remember this.
How did I get 25? What the hell am I doing here? I wrote down slide 25, but who knows what this... I'm going to look at slide 25.
14, right? This is slide 14.
Yeah.
Yeah, 514.
That would have meant your last one would have been 24, and it's about the Catholic reaction to the debt.
Yeah.
So we got to go back to slide 14. Right?
Yeah, I think this is where we start.
Okay, I don't know what I got here. There's no tell.
So Anne, why don't you read this?
Okay. The Social Security Act 1935, the single most important poverty-fighting legislation in America. And that's our lingo. Tom Paine, father of the American Revolution, was the first to propose old age pensions, as well as giving young families money to set up their households. From the website of the Social Security Administration, Thomas Paine. In the winter of 1795 to 96, Thomas Paine wrote his last great pamphlet, Agrarian Justice. The pamphlet was first published in French in Paris. An English edition was brought out in 1797. In this pamphlet, Paine advocated the creation of a social insurance scheme for the aged and for young people just starting out in life. The benefits were to be paid from a national fund accumulated for this purpose. The fund was to be financed by a 10% tax on inherited property. His plan was quite modern, recognizing the problem of income security for the elderly and the desirability of creating a national fund for this purpose. Since the early 1970s, the financial elite has incessantly worked to destroy Social Security, created directly by government and paid to recipients. Oh, it would be best to have the money created directly by government and paid to recipients.
So So that would be the debt-free money.
Yeah.
They're sure behind the times, aren't they? 1797, they're 1970. Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Right now, they're really good at it, so. Yeah, and I found the right note. It was just on the other side of this note.
You're not crazy.
Yeah. So, my goodness, I mean, Tom Paine was, he was a modern man.
And giving young families money to set up their households.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we did that with the thing for the veterans after World War II to buy a house.
Yeah. The loans, well, there were loans, but they were cheap veterans loans.
Yeah. So.
They got cheap houses in Levittown.
We're slow learners, aren't we?
Very, very slow.
Yeah. Not too many Tom Paines around.
It's because we're resisted by it.
Now, would they call him a socialist or a communist? You know, would people, the elites say, oh, that's socialistic. Oh, that's communistic.
Yeah.
What did they call him in his day?
They didn't have to use those words.
No, they wouldn't have had those words.
Marx.
But a lot of people
radical.
Were radical. I don't know.
Radical?
A lot of people were against
far
it.
Out or
a revolutionary?
Yes, he was a revolutionary against England. That was his whole game. Yeah.
And then I think he came into conflict with the elites in this country, right?
Well, yeah.
Yes, he criticized Washington.
Yeah.
George Washington. Not the city.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
President.
Yes, quite a story. Because he almost died during the French Revolution while he was in France.
Yeah, they were going down from door to door, something like that. And
looking for him.
They were looking for him, really?
No, I'm asking you, why were they going from door to door?
Oh, for rounding up a bunch of people. He was on the list.
Oh.
But he wasn't home. He was somewhere else.
Yeah, he almost died. And then he got help. Someone in this country, I think Ben Franklin helped him. Well, Ben Franklin was dead by that time, right? The late
1890.
Yeah, Ben Franklin died
in 1790.
1790, 1991.
Yeah.
Someone back here helped him, and he came back to this country, but he died in poverty.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he was living in New Jersey.
Well, if you have good ideas, you're going to die in poverty.
But I think Benjamin Franklin would definitely have been of a same mind with him.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, how come?
Historic collapse of the gold-silver ratio. The Great Depression caused the price of silver to collapse. Silver dropped from $1.38 per ounce in 1919 to 44 cents an ounce in 1932, down three quarters of the way, 75%. Gold was still $20.67 per ounce, its value protected by law. That's interesting, I never heard of that before with gold. The sanction of the law, and earlier the sanctification of the temple, was still valid for commodity gold, but had been withdrawn from commodity silver. The law is what determined the ratio. The sanction of the law is what determined the value of the precious metal as money.
And that's one of Stephen's themes.
The monetary theories of Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Karl Marx, and von Mises, and the Austrians, all of which assert a commodity or quasi-commodity nature of money, are refuted by the reality of the silver collapse.
Yeah, collapse because it was not supported by the legal system anymore.
Yeah. The gold was, but not the other.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's another example of money is actually an abstract function in the law, determined by law, regardless of whatever it's made out of.
Sure.
Yeah. Will, do the next one.
Okay. Same historic collapse of gold-silver ratio. 1933, December the 21st, proclamation number 2067, Roosevelt ordered the U.S. mints to buy the entire domestic production of newly mined silver at 64.5 cents per ounce. This increased the money supply slightly. 1934, June 19th, the Silver Purchase Act of 1934 directed the Treasury to purchase all silver at home and abroad until silver was one-fourth the stock of gold and silver. The Treasury was directed to issue silver certificates against the reserve of silver coin or bullion. The President was authorized to require silver's delivery to the mint in return for payment of its fair value in any U.S. currency. And Secretary
Montague was one of the people who started the Bank of England.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there was a Montague somewhere. Morgenthau lost no time in making a statement. A Washington dispatch of June the 21st to the New York Times said, "The Treasury will carry out enthusiastically the policy written into the Silver Purchase Act and will buy at home and abroad when the metal is offered at a reasonable price," said Secretary Morgenthau today. He added that every effort would be made, however, to guard against speculative activities which might have unfortunate results. What we want is a rise in the price of silver, but we don't want a sensational price rise, because the worst thing that could happen would be to have silver go up and then have a collapse, said Mr. Morgenthau. And that's a website that you've got that next. Decided to. 1934, August the 9th, Executive Order 6814, Roosevelt ordered the seizure of all silver in the continental United States, excluding silver coins.
So that increased a little bit the money supply. We had these and then silver certificates circulating in the United States, backed by
so
the
So that
silver.
Means if you had a set of silver that you weighed with and all that, they would confiscate it?
I'm not sure the details. You can keep your silver coins. They didn't want to reduce the money supply that way. But all silver.
All silver.
Yeah. It says all silver.
Forced.
Yeah.
Not would you like to sell it?
I would think definitely silver bullion.
And bricks and stuff.
Maybe not silver that was made and everyone was making, then everyone could take their bullion and make silver forks and spoons and keep them.
Yeah. Forks and spoons.
Oh, yes. Yes. Martin, do the next one.
Okay, five. The money supply finally starts increasing. And one more insult from the Fed. Take a look at this. Okay, then as the recovery was getting underway, the newly constituted Fed Board of Governors made a last ignorant gesture of obstructionism and doubled the reserve requirement in the 1936 to 1937 period, cutting short the recovery and hamstringing the money supply. This demonstrated the continuing banker domination of the system at Stevens and Angular Science of Money, page 564. And here we seem to have chart 37 from Friedman and Schwartz, page 494. Money, stock, income, income prices at velocity, personal income and industrial production in reference cycle expansions and contractions, March 1933 to December 1941, basically from the start of the Great Depression to the onset of World War II, well, the American involvement in World War II.
Right, but notice the gray line in the center.
Yeah, that's where the money stock went down. and everything else went down.
Yeah, they stopped the recovery. Before, you can see the money stock was going up.
Yeah.
The prices,
everything was even.
Prices were going up. Industrial production was going up. Look at that.
That made the biggest drop. There's a line there where it just went horizontal in the middle. What is that?
That's a price index.
Average.
Implicit, whatever that is. But everything else went down. They just stopped the recovery. You can imagine the lives that were affected by that.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, they're already affected. Now this. I don't know.
So they were aware of velocity of money. I see there.
What are you looking at?
In chart 37, right underneath the number 37. And velocity. And we're aware of that at the time.
Yeah, here's the velocity. That line there, the fourth from the top, is the velocity. That went down, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you just have to wonder, Stephen attributes this to ignorance. You really have to wonder, is it really ignorance?
Or mouth.
But I also seem to remember that Congress backed off fiscal stimulus about the same time, too, in the 36 to 37 time period.
You mean the New Deal? New Deal?
Yeah, New Deal stimulus, they backed off.
Oh.
They opposed it.
Okay. Well, that could certainly affect it.
Sue is respecting malice, not just ignorance.
Oh, yeah.
So. Malevolence.
I am.
Yeah.
It just feels the outcome of the Great Depression just left the Federal Reserve with more power when they were the cause of it.
Yeah.
They should have had more oversight by the government, not less. I mean, it was the government that had the New Deal and saved the banking system and started at least some recovery, you know? And do the next one.
How easy it is to create money financing World War II. It would not be until World War II that full monetary expansion was allowed and full employment was sought, when it was assured the employment and money would be channeled into destruction rather than production of infrastructure, houses, and other useful items.
That sounds like an architect.
Americans haven't understood that it is the financiers who are the ones initiating real violence, depression, and war under cover of economic theory.
Yeah, architects want to see all the buildings fall down, but none of the people to get hurt.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So they can rebuild them again.
Channeled into destruction. Huh.
Yeah.
My question is, why would the bankers be happy to channel money into war, but be unhappy to channel money into production and infrastructure?
I think because of countries at war, they'll do anything to get money, and they'll pay higher interest rates. They'll accept, the banks can charge higher interest rates and have more lending. It's a big one.
Okay. I see your point.
Yeah, they're desperate to win the war.
That's a good point, though.
Yeah.
It also leaves the countries at war vulnerable, losing assets, control over
their assets. They're losing all that infrastructure. That's great for the banks, because then when the war is over, they have to borrow more money to build all the infrastructure.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
That's right. And gets rid of a few million people, you know. They're like bugs on the earth anyway,
collateral,
to the bankers.
Collateral damage.
Yeah.
Well, we certainly leveled 26 cities in Germany, pretty much leveled them about like Dresden.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Bankers can loan all money to rebuild them.
Don't forget Tokyo,
Atomic bomb. Hiroshima. And then Nagasaki.
Yeah, if you listen to Richard Werner's video, Princes of the Yen, about the reconstitution of the Japanese banking system from the end of World War II to the present, you see how the banking system was run by the Americans. You know, Americans were, they were in Japan as conquerors, and they helped, they were deciding how to reconstitute that banking system. You know, so that's, you know, infiltrating into the other country.
MacArthur wrote the Constitution for Japan himself alone.
I don't know if I believe that, but...
No, that's him.
I thought that too.
He's a dictator, very bright guy, probably did a good job, but he did it himself, and they forced it on the Japanese, which probably made good use of it.
Well, how do you know it's a good constitution? Is he, was he, what did he have? What did he have that made him the person that should write the constitution? What was his qualification?
Well, his
he was the conqueror.
He won the war.
He was a bit of a megalomaniac. He wanted to take charge and make everything. He wanted to do it all.
Yeah, he thought everybody else was a joke.
Now, whether Japan has that same constitution today, I doubt that it still exists in that
amendments.
Form.
Yeah.
I was going to say something.
And MacArthur was...
Very bright guy.
Yeah, but he got a little out of hand, didn't he?
Yeah, Truman told him, you're fired. In Korea, when he wanted to invade mainland China.
Yeah.
He cut off the North Koreans.
Yeah.
That's the story, okay. Don, do the... Oh, we did this one. Did we do this one? Oh, no. Don, do this one.
Six, how easy it is to create money financing World War II. Channeling the new money into production rather than destruction would have tended to create value, keep prices down, and not required unnecessary loss of life, says Steve Zarlinga. From July 1st, 1940 to December 1941.
How many months is that?
July?
Six.
July, August. Yes, it is, yeah.
18 months, right?
Yep. No, six.
Oh, 40.
Oh, the next year, you're right.
A year and a half, approximately, right? Okay.
Expenditures totaled $21.7 billion. Far in excess of anything previously spent by the New Deal.
In a year and a half, they were able to allow the spigots to open and create that much bank credit.
So that's what Roosevelt did. He encouraged the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor by kicking them around with oil. He cut off their oil supplies. So he had a war going, and when they have a war going, you can lend a lot of money because you've got to win that war. The national debt in February 1946, 5 years later, was $279.8 billion. 31% of this debt, $87 billion, was that held by the commercial banks, can be considered as money that they created out of thin air. And there were purple arrows.
Excuse me. You said that that Roosevelt encouraged Japan to start a war by cutting off their oil supply.
Yeah,
that's right. So he tempted them. He wanted them to.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what the Bushes were talking about. What we need is another Pearl Harbor.
Great.
Yeah.
But the real question is, what did the bankers want? Because they're the ones holding the power over the purse, not the government.
But the Bushes were the politicians. They're supposed to do the talking.
Yeah, but what really is going on is the bank is going to decide to create that money for the war.
Okay.
You know. So, Don, you want
to... I can't see them.
This is monetary expansion allowed for the war, is the chart on the right. So it also has real income, money stock, the velocity of money, the price index, implicit and wholesale, and industrial production. So this is 1939, it starts, and it goes all the way to 1948. And after the war, you can see after the war, in 45, there's a contraction. But during the war, the money stock was going up, so was incomes, so was the prices, and industrial production. Money created for destruction.
Hmm. Yeah, that's the big time. It's the big game.
Yeah. We'll do the next one.
Aftermath, propaganda to resurrect capitalism's moral standing. Oh my. Roosevelt's inaugural address, March 1933. The end of the belittlement of government and the end of trust in free markets. Our distress comes from no fair. This is Franklin Roosevelt's
speech.
Inaugural address. Our distress comes from no failure of substance. Nature still offers her bounty and human efforts have multiplied it. Plenty is at our doorstep. But a generous use of it languishes in the very slight sight of the supply. Primarily, this is because the rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence, have admitted their failure and have abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. The money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of civilization. The measure of the restoration lies in the extent to which we apply social values more noble than mere monetary profit.
Wow.
Franklin Roosevelt's inaugural address.
Right.
So, what? What did that all mean?
Oh.
What was he trying to say?
Well, the first paragraph is explaining how if you don't have money, you can't. The society can't function, right?
Yeah.
So there's all this, there's nature's bounty, there's food, there's
effort,
minerals,
labor, wants dying
labor,
to work,
yes.
And all this money gone. No, we can't afford it.
Right.
We can't afford it.
There's no money. There's a scarcity of money.
Materials available, plenty of resources.
So then, and then he says, it's the bankers.
Mm-hmm.
That have been shown to be the problem.
The money changers.
Yeah, that's what he called them.
Yeah.
They fled from their high seats. So now it's up to government. He just stepped into being the president. He's going to start the New Deal and start getting people working, get some more money into their hands, whatever he has to do. So here he said, listen, you know, the government has to do something. The financiers, the bankers, they've caused the Great Depression. So you would think that the bankers would be put in their place.
But they weren't.
But they weren't.
No, and he's saying here, it's up to get into the restoration. We have to apply social values more noble than mere monetary profit.
Exactly.
And some of that did happen, but the bankers were not straightened out.
They hadn't done anything, but I think that when Roosevelt threatened them and said the government's going to do it, that they panicked and they started operating with him.
Oh. Well, they started buying some securities in the open market operations, mm-hmm. but as soon as Congress disbanded for the year, they pretty much stopped doing that.
Yeah.
They really never look what the bankers can do when war, when there's a war.
Mm-hmm.
How they create the money. There's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
What's, you know, but when people are starving and, you know, and living in cardboard boxes,
mm-hmm.
there's a problem creating
no,
money.
Well, they say that's no problem. It's not a really problem. Bad habits problem.
Yeah.
It's the people's problem. It's
yeah.
They cause that. There's, you know, they don't want to work, whatever.
And loafers are good for nothing.
You know.
Well, and, God's did that because, you know, it's because of them, God did it.
So this is, you know, been erased. This is erased, this history.
Yeah.
You know. And Roosevelt, you know, there's a lot to his credit. He was not a revolutionary, and he did not take the power away from the Federal Reserve.
He was from a banker family, wasn't
he?
Yeah. Will, do the next one.
Seven, aftermath. Propaganda still to resurrect capitalism. Blame the government. Decades later, this is Arlinda speaking in Lost Science and Money on page 567. Decades later, when many participants and memories were dead, concerted attempts began by a cabal of economists and financiers to shift blame for creating and prolonging the Depression away from the financiers and the Federal Reserve System onto the governments. Okay. And then Ayn Rand says gold and economic freedom, and gold and economic freedom, capitalism, the unknown ideal, published in 1967. Alan Greenspan used the conservatives' basic ploy, blaming the evils of the private Federal Reserve System on government. And so, the Federal Reserve System was organized in 1913. It consisted of 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, nominally owned by the private bankers, but in fact, government-sponsored, controlled, and supported.
And it's the reverse.
Wait a minute. That's not right.
That's Alan Greenspan writing that in her book. That's his article in her book, Golden Economic Freedom.
Oh.
So that's the words of Alan Greenspan.
Oh,
it says capitalism and the unknown ideal.
Yeah, that's her book. It's a compilation of articles.
Yeah.
Oh, this is what happened years before.
The Federal Reserve System is owned by the member banks, and the member banks are owned by the private bankers.
Yeah, well, they say their lies, and if you say them over and over again,
yeah,
and they have all this prestige in the society, so, you know, people who don't know think, well, they must know what they're talking about. It's our problem, yeah. Is that we're too trusting.
Okay, now Zarlinga says again on page 567, this false view ignores the attempts of several past Democratic chairmen of the House Banking Committee to pass laws to nationalize or do away with the Federal Reserve System. If the Fed is already a government entity, these economists shouldn't mind too much when it gets nationalized. Well, yeah, they should.
That's really true, isn't it? I mean, you know.
Uh-huh.
If it's really a government entity, so what?
Yes.
So let's.
What's the problem?
Let's nationalize it.
You can't have it both ways. Martin, do the next one.
Okay, aftermath. Propaganda to resurrect capitalism's moral standing. The Austrian School of Economics. Blame the government. The Austrian economist F.A. Hayek wrote Denationalization of Money, published in 1978. The long depression of the 1930s was wholly due to the mismanagement of money by government before as well as after the crisis of 1929. End of quote. Quoting again, It was not capitalism, but government intervention that has been responsible for the recurrent crises of the past. End quote. And we have a cartoon here, and it looks remarkably like Congress to me. And it says, somebody over in left there, we control Congress now. you said. We control the White House now, you said. You neglected that. Now we've got nobody to blame anything on.
But I put in that little cloud.
Private lands, Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
See, everything covers up the role and power of the money system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They won't introduce it into our consciousness. Mm-hmm. As a society. Yeah.
So you own the government, but now you're telling us that the government is the problem.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. Who owns the government?
It deflects.
Yeah.
It deflects. It sets up a straw man, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's right. Because I have to remember, it's the government that would have the power to take the power away from the Federal Reserve. It's the only institution that would.
Yeah.
You know.
We're going to do it.
And I always remember that when the Bank of England was created, the first thing they did when they printed up their banknotes, right, was to go into the Parliament and buy off the parliamentarians.
Oh.
That was the first thing they did. Because they were the people that could take the charter away from them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they filled a briefcase full of £100 notes, took it to the parliamentarian, did you say? Or
yeah.
Did
they, Bribed them.
Who's that?
The Bank of England when it was first started printing banknotes. You know, when it got its charter. And do the next one.
Aftermath, the Catholic reaction to the debacle.
What do they do?
Papal encyclical, Pope Pius XI, May 15th, 1931. Quadragesimo anno, Latin, in the 40th year.
Yeah.
This letter from the Pope was named after the 40th anniversary of Leo 13th encyclical Rerum Novarum, 1891. Both dealt with the modern industrial economy.
That's what Rerum Novarum means, a new deal.
But Pius XI spoke explicitly of the evils of finance capitalism. Zarlenga, a remarkable document. Pope Pius XI in 1930. Pius was Pope between the two world wars and during the Great Depression, 1922 to 1939.
That's when he was Pope. He's writing this. Look at the date he's issuing this.
1931.
May of 31. Mm-hmm. So this is in the depths of the Depression.
Right.
You know, we're in the middle of first going to the second. We just had the second banking crisis. People are tramping around the country, living in hovels.
Yeah.
Around the world, people are suffering. Yeah.
Well, wasn't there something about Pope Pius XI cooperating with Hitler?
With who?
That was Pius XII, wasn't it?
Because it's 1922 and 1939. Well, but Hitler was in power then.
Yeah, but that didn't really happen until the Germans really started conquering Europe at that point.
Well, by this time, Hitler had created a government created money.
Yeah, he had.
Called the Fetter.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure the Pope knew about it, and it was the thing that started the economic recovery of Germany.
Yeah.
They were paying the workers and their suppliers in the Fetter. It was government created, not by the bankers, not by debt.
and massive government spending on the military.
Yeah.
The next chapter is all about that.
Okay.
It's all about Germany's money system. From the early 20s through into the 30s.
Well, that was a big incentive.
Say it louder.
So that was a big incentive for the Allies to stop Germany. Because Germans would ruin
the banking system.
Yeah, they would ruin the bankers' chances to make money.
And to control the world.
And
it would
serve as a model for other people to see how efficient that was.
That's right. Get rid of the bankers. He was like Lincoln, the Civil War. Well, let's make our own money.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And they fought the Civil War. So I wonder how Hitler did it. They were devastated after World War I. Where did they get the dough to do this?
They were also being supported by American capitalists.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They were supporting Hitler. Uh-huh. Definitely. Some very important American capitalists were giving him money.
They were going where the money was to be made.
Yeah,
exactly. Interesting. I mean, little did they know then, I don't think, that 15 years later, they were going to be looking back on the devastation.
Who's they?
The bankers, I think, or whoever. Whoever that was helping Hitler.
I don't know. They were helping him. Germany at a certain point.
They've been on both sides of the war. Yeah.
That's what bankers do.
Yeah.
That's what international bankers do. Mm-hmm. They've been on both sides of the war. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Okay.
Don, the next one.
The Catholic reaction to the debacle. No longer would the Church automatically provide easy moral support for powerful systems and rich individuals doing evil undercover of conservative economic theory. That's a quote from Zarenga.
This is from his encyclical, number 71 in his encyclical and number 88 in his encyclical.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. But the quote up there at the top is not from anything the Pope said?
No, that's Zarenga.
Okay. So 71 says, in the first place, the worker must be paid a wage sufficient to support him and his family. 88, the right ordering of economic life cannot be left to a free competition of forces. Far from this source, from a poisoned spring, have originated and spread all the errors of individualist economic teaching. But free competition, while justified and certainly useful, provided it is kept within certain limits, clearly cannot direct economic life, a truth which the outcome of the application in practice of the tenets of this evil individualistic spirit has more than sufficiently demonstrated it, the truth.
Right, so free competition without regulation has proved itself. He's writing this in the middle of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. This is the proof. Mm-hmm. You just can't let it be unregulated.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's not going to work.
Did anybody react to that encyclical, I wonder? Did it make an impact on anybody?
Well, Stephen Zarlanger has felt it's very important. We'll do the next one.
All the Catholic churches probably gave sermons.
Pius XI then addressed some key monetary matters, page 569 and 105. In the first place, it is obvious that not only is wealth concentrated in our times, but an immense power and despotic economic dictatorship is consolidated in the hands of a few who often are not owners, but only trustees and managing directors of invested funds, which they administer according to their own arbitrary will and pleasure. It's not even their money. Okay. 106, that this dictatorship is being most forcibly exercised by those who, since they hold the money and completely control it, control credit also and rule the lending of money. Hence, they regulate the flow, so to speak, of the lifeblood whereby the entire economic system lives, and have so firmly in their grasp the soul, as it were, of economic life, that no one can breathe against their will.
Well, he saw the truth of the economic financial system.
He didn't even realize that they create money out of blue air, blue sky.
I'm not sure about that.
That's not mentioned in there anywhere.
Not yet.
Okay.
It's coming then.
He said he's talking about control credit.
Yeah.
Right? Hence, they regulate the flow of the lifeblood. So at least he's saying that, right?
Yeah.
Martin, do the next one.
Okay, the encyclical pointed out with foresight in 1931 that this financial system was inexorably moving forwards towards warfare. That's Stephen Lazalenga, Lost Science of Money, page 569. And from the encyclical, 107. This concentration of power and might, the characteristic mark, as it were, of contemporary economic life, is the fruit that the unlimited freedom of struggle among competitors has of its own nature produced, and which lets only the strongest survive. And this is often the same as saying, those who fight the most violently, those who give the least heed to their conscience. And 108, this accumulation of might and power generates in turn three kinds of conflict. First, there is the struggle for economic supremacy itself. Then there is the bitter fight to gain supremacy over the state in order to use in economic struggles its resources and authority. Finally, there is conflict between states themselves. A few years after that, the world plunged into World War II.
Yeah?
Yeah.
1936.
His foresight in 1931.
And it's what the bankers created, in other words, the crash and the Great Depression, which actually brought Adolf Hitler to power.
Yeah.
If the bankers hadn't done what they'd done, Adolf Hitler wouldn't have come to power.
Yeah, they like to create crises. That's how they gain more power. Okay. And do this.
Very significantly, while noting the importance of charity, Quadragesimo Anno suggested that juridical actions, legislative remedies, were also called for. Free competition kept within definite and due limits, and still more economic dictatorship, must be effectively brought under public authority in these matters which pertain to the latter's function. This, and Zarlinger says, this represented an important shift toward real reform.
Yeah, 1931. Done.
The Church of England defangs the Bank of England. The Church of England took the greatest monetary initiative of the 20th century when it called for the nationalization of the Bank of England. Steve Zarlinga says, page 571. William Temple became Archbishop of Canterbury in 1942 when a German invasion seemed likely. He worked for the relief of Jewish refugees from Nazism and publicly supported a negotiated peace, as opposed to the unconditional surrender that the Allied leaders were demanding. Temple's admirers have called him a philosopher, theologian, social teacher, educational reformer, and the leader of the ecumenical movement of his generation. The most significant Anglican churchman of the 20th century, the most renowned primate in the Church of England since the English Reformation, Anglican's most creative and comprehensive contribution to the theological enterprise of the West. Born in 1881, died in 1944, that's pretty close to the end of the war, Archbishop of Canterbury, and the year just from 42 till he died in 44.
So he had a very significant impact on his nation.
Mm-hmm.
For that short period he was Archbishop. Will, do the next one.
Okay. Still kind of going over that one. Okay. Just a sec.
Okay.
Okay. The Church of England took the greatest monetary initiative, okay, 20th century, okay, nationalized the Bank of England, London, September the 26th, 1942. Is this what?
These are the quotes from William Temple on in London in 1942.
Okay. In the case of money, we are dealing with something which is handled in our generations by methods that are extremely different from those in vogue a century or a half ago, when there was a multitude of private banks. The system by which credit was issued may have perhaps been appropriate, but with the amalgamation of the banks, we have now reached a stage where something universally needed, namely money or credit, which does duty for money, has become, in effect, a monopoly. The private issue of new credit should be regarded in the modern world in just the same way in which the private minting of money was regarded in earlier times. The banks should be limited in their lending power to the amount deposited by their clients, while the issue of newer credit should be the function of public authority. Wow. This is not in any way to censure the banks or bankers. They have administered the system entrusted to them with singular uprightness and ability and public spirit. But the system has begun
anomalous.
Abnormal, okay. And as so often happens when anomaly has persisted through a long period of time, the result is to make into the master what ought to be the servant.
I like that. Now I can think of the banking system as an abnormal system.
Yeah.
Well, he definitely knew where money came from, credit came from.
He did.
An anomaly is.
Yeah, why did he have to apologize for the bankers, saying that they were upright and public spirited?
An anomaly is something that's different from normal.
Yeah.
Well, you know, most bankers really don't know their system. I mean, it's the financiers at the top, the wheelers and dealers, that are making the crucial decisions. You know, most bankers in an ordinary community bank, you know, regional bank.
How could they not know where the money comes from that they loan?
It's all in the accounting.
So these guys didn't pass accounting class.
You know, when I was working at my multinational bank a number of years ago, and I was working with the controller of the corporate bank. So he's the head accountant. And I asked him, I said, tell me, do you know that banks create money? He said, no, it comes from the Fed. They're just accountants.
Just accountants.
You know, it's just move that figure there over to there. But the people who understand the impact of what the system is doing, those are the ones that know. They're the ones that go to the Bilderberger conferences. They're the ones that send the messages to the Bank for International Settlement and do this, do that, you know. But the ordinary banker he doesn't really know. He doesn't really know.
The me and Will know somebody, a gentleman named Ethan. He has a friend who worked as an economist at the IMF, and he basically swore, I'm telling you, blew in the face that the Fed didn't create money, that the banks didn't create money.
Right.
I mean, he's an economist working at the Fed, and he doesn't know how money's created.
It's true. I mean, I think positive money had to go into the bank and educate the people at the Bank of England.
Mm-hmm. That's what they're doing right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just really... it's really what it is what it is. You know? Martin, do the next one.
Okay. Aftermath of the game. The Bank of England was nationalized in 1946 to much much happy, jolly shouting. But unfortunately, it was no longer in England, but America, where the problem was never concentrated. Stephen Lazelenga, The Lost Science of Money, page 571. Just a few decades too late, damn it.
Exactly.
Okay, let's see what we're looking at here. Public as of January 1st, 2009. This is some confidential thing. I 5.2, Board of the Governors of the Federal Reserve System, Division of Research and Statistics International Section. Mm. Queue of Foreign Development, September 10th, 1945. A speech made by Mr. Montague Norman, Governor of the Bank of England, at Mansion House in 1936 is frequently cited to mark the formal surrender of the independence of the bank after the adoption of new financial machinery following the departure from the gold standard in 1931. The speech contains the assurance that the ministers will at all times find us willing, with goodwill and loyalty, to do what they direct us as though we were under legal compulsion. Huh. Wow.
Yeah.
After the outburst of debate and discussion following announcement of the pending nationalization, it seems likely the bill, when it appears, will prove to be an anticlimax. Oh.
So this was the Federal Reserve writing 2009, looking back and analyzing the nationalization of the Bank of England and saying, well, it was definitely going to be nationalized because the bank had given up its sovereignty to the government already. You know, so they're interested in these kinds of things, you know, the history of how it happens. They want to protect themselves. They don't want it to happen to them.
Didn't that lawyer at the meeting last year who helped Kucinich prepare the bill in Congress? Didn't he say that there were a lot of, what do they call them, what's the word, people who advocate to the, you know. What?
Lobbyists,
yeah. A lot of lobbyists were trying to get him to write the bill in favor of the banks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And when he tried to rewrite a certain part of the bill to make it clearer,
yeah,
they rushed in and they had a crisis over the weekend because they didn't want him to make it clearer.
Like, yeah.
over H.R. 2990.
Yeah.
The writing of H.R. 2990.
Yeah.
Oh.
And do the last one. These are the last one.
in less than 20 years, the Federal Reserve brought out money system, banks, exchanges, and economy to utter ruin. The bankers refused to do anything using the, quote, fear of inflation, unquote, argument in the middle of the worst deflation of the century. Government, not the banks, rescued the situation. Bankers allowed a large creation of new money only when it was devoted to warfare. The, quote, free market culture of the 1920s was reestablished. The nation's exchanges either circumvented or removed the regulations put in place to stop another crash.
Yeah. That's why this history is so important.
Yeah.
And then we got the same result in 2008.
The same what, Martin?
Then we got the same result as happened in the...
Oh, 2008.
It's in the 1930s, and after 2008.
Right, and right. Yeah, well, that's the system, that, you know, the ups and downs of the business cycle, the crises. No one ever, you know, the voices that say, wait a minute, we have to change the system, they get pushed aside, you know. Like